I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Pressure could mount on Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to resign amid charges that he mismanaged the investigation into the treatment of Iraqi detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad. Graphic new photos of prisoners undergoing sexual humiliation and torture are in the Washington Post today. All this as the Bush administration called for $25 billion more in funding for Iraq and Afghanistan. John Diamond covers the Pentagon for USA Today, and he joins us now from Washington. Hi, John.
Good afternoon.
John, is there any sense among correspondents who take the pace of this Pentagon daily that Rumsfeld could wind up having to resign or be fired?
There is. This is a crisis, the most serious crisis by far to face Rumsfeld during his tenure in terms of his own standing. He received what is being characterized as a mild rebuke yesterday from President Bush, but even that is extremely unusual for Rumsfeld, who has clearly been a favorite of the president throughout. He is seen as the chief architect of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, which obviously, as everyone can tell, is not going well now. And he is seen as having been at the helm of a system that resulted in these terrible abuses. And the best defense he can offer is that he was unaware of them and that the problems were not being reported up the chain of command adequately and that there was poor supervision, which is a weak argument coming from someone who has such a well-established record as a man who is firmly in control of the organization he heads.
John, in the matter of the prison scandal, can you briefly pull what chronology there is together? When did the defense secretary learn of the problems at Abu Ghraib prison?
The incidents occurred in the fall. The investigative report comes out, not internally, of course, in January. Rumsfeld, there is a public statement made without any details in mid-January. Rumsfeld in February gets briefed on it but does not read the report. And at some time within the last few weeks, CBS's 60 Minutes 2 program gets a hold of some of these photographs, which had been circulating privately on the Internet, apparently, among soldiers and so forth. And so at that point, high levels in the Pentagon, and particularly Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Richard Myers, are engaged trying to convince CBS not to air those photographs because of the crisis they knew they would touch off. Even then, Rumsfeld does not read the report or look at the pictures. He tells a Pentagon news conference earlier this week that he asked about them and was told they weren't available, which is an answer that's really hard to understand, again, given that he is the man in charge, and usually when he asks for something, he gets it and gets it right quick. So that's a rough sketch of the chain of events here.
John, we're going to have more analysis of the Secretary of Defense's situation coming up in just a moment. But in the less than a minute that we have left, I want to ask you about this $25 billion more requested now for Iraq and Afghanistan. The sense seems to be that will pass Congress without much trouble in the name of supporting the troops. But others are saying that's a low ball number. Your thoughts?
Yes, that is the belief, that it's a low ball number. It was widely expected that a request would come up. The administration was trying to postpone it until after the election. That became impossible. It's such a massive mission, consuming funds so rapidly, and especially with the extension of troop deployments now indefinitely at the 138,000 level.
John Diamond covers the Pentagon for USA Today.
As we mentioned, the press is weighing in heavily today on Secretary Rumsfeld's future. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch wants the defense secretary to step down over what the newspaper calls his many missteps and, quote, arrogant inability to admit his mistakes. The New York Times columnist Tom Friedman says Rumsfeld should resign, quote, today, not tomorrow, not next month, to repair America's image in the world. For more, we're joined by Bill Emmett, who is editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine, and he's on the line from London. Bill, welcome.
Hello.
Also on the line is Peter Greer. He's the Washington editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with Bill, first from London. The upcoming issue of The Economist will have on its cover one of these pictures of abuse that we now know so well, and two words across the top, resign Rumsfeld. Why do you want Rumsfeld to go?
I think for the same reason as the St. Louis Dispatch and Tom Friedman, fundamentally, that I think this is so serious that the person at the top should take responsibility, even if it's not his fault. But I do actually, in addition to that, think that he shares some culpability for what's happened because of the culture of extra-legal behavior and disdain for foreigners of various sorts, but particularly Muslim foreigners, that he has set since the early days of the war on terror. And while I can understand him having done it, I think that it has had bad consequences and he should take responsibility for it.
Peter, let's turn to you. What's the buzz in Washington now? Is support for Rumsfeld eroding in the corridors of power?
Well, I think the first thing you have to remember is what we're seeing here is part of a well-honed Washington ritual. It isn't as if President Bush watched television, saw these pictures, jumped up and said, you know, I'm really angry. Get Rummy on the phone. It's more likely there was a meeting at some point in which everyone was going around the room going, well, should we say he's angry? Should we say he's outraged? You know, what kind of a face should we put to the press? And what we don't know is what, or if anything, he said to Rumsfeld separately. You know, he well may have had somebody call up the Secretary of Defense and go, you know, I got to hit you publicly, but I don't really mean it, so hang in there. Or he maybe didn't say anything, in which case this is a serious signal that he really perhaps does want Mr. Rumsfeld to think about resigning.
Well, let's talk about what happened in the papers today. Several major newspapers ran stories saying that they were briefed by White House officials at the authorization of President Bush, saying that President Bush called Donald Rumsfeld into the Oval Office to complain about the handling of this scandal, complain that he was not told about the photos that existed of the abuse at this prison. You're saying that this might not be anything more than just ritual, that this might not mean anything.
It might not. But what we don't know is we just don't know what the full transcript of that meeting was. You know, you remember that this is an administration that has prided itself on not showing weakness. And in saying this, in essence, they have showed a little weakness. One of his main cabinet members, you know, he said, I'm angry with one of my main cabinet members. That's it's very out of character for the Bush administration to give anyone an opening to criticize any of their own top officials. And the degree of the anger that has at least been allegedly expressed is such that I think the buzz in Washington is that it's quite possible that Mr. Rumsfeld is going to resign.
Well, Bill, as a member of the chattering classes, I guess, do you think that certainly the press has now seemed to be stepping up their calls for Rumsfeld's resignation? Is this, simply the press being the press, or do you see editorials like yours having any real effect on decisions that are made in Washington?
Well, I think that the press is being the press. We all get the smell of blood and go for it. It's true. But I think it reflects the seriousness of the allegations that are there, the fact that the scandal is widening. And therefore, I think the dilemma for both Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush is how to stop this, how to bring it to a halt. The best way would be probably to tough it out if they could. That's what they'd like to do. But it may well be that both of them will realize that what needs to happen is for Donald Rumsfeld to take a bullet for George Bush, because it's going to get damaging for the president as well. Of course, the dilemma is that his resignation could fuel it. And that's what Peter says rightly, that they don't want to show weakness because that could fuel the furore. But I think they might conclude that he needs to take the bullet.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Great pleasure.
Anytime.
Bill Emmett is editor-in-chief of The Economist magazine, and Peter Greer is Washington editor of the Christian Science Monitor.
The International Red Cross says it visited the Abu Ghraib prison repeatedly over the last 6 months, making its concerns and observations known to American prison administrators in detailed reports. Joining us on the line from Amman, Jordan, is International Red Cross spokesperson Nada Dumani. Welcome, Nada.
Hello. Thank you.
Nada, thanks for joining us. For how long has the Red Cross been aware of abuse at Abu Ghraib prison?
Well, in fact, to be precise, we just said that we were aware of the whole overall situation in Abu Ghraib. As you probably know, the ICRC reports and the content of our findings when we visit detainees is not disclosed publicly. So what we can say for the time being is we've been visiting Abu Ghraib prison since October last year. And as usual, following each visit, we do have dialogue with the detaining authorities, with the director of the prison. And then we do make a report that we hand over to the detaining authorities right after the visit. So in this report, we do include all our remarks, all our recommendations, whatever we have heard from the detainees, whatever we have witnessed, etc. And, of course, our delegates who do the job, they know exactly how to speak with the people and get some information, specifically those regarding ill treatment.
What response did you get?
The U.S. authorities have reacted very seriously to our comments and our recommendations. Now, it doesn't mean that some practices have stopped or not, but what we're saying is that they have been taken seriously by the U.S.
The U.S. authorities reacted very seriously. Do you mean in their demeanor, or did they take action, so far as you know?
No, both.
Both. You say they took action. Do you have a sense that practices of abuse at Abu Ghraib were being reined back in the wake of the Red Cross talking to the detaining authorities?
Well, I do hope that our reports have been instrumental in some way. But what I said is that also in this report, it's not specifically about all these abuses that we've seen, the pictures, etc. We have raised different kind of issues when we are in a detention place. I mean, we are also concerned about if people are getting proper food, water, etc. And all these issues have been dealt with in the report, and the U.S. authorities have taken action concerning a certain number of issues.
What was your reaction when you saw the photographs?
They are shocking, they are appalling, unacceptable.
Was it a situation that seemed to be revealed in those photographs which was worse than you imagined at Abu Ghraib?
I have to say that we were not totally surprised.
Why not?
Because we've been in Abu Ghraib and we've talked to people and we knew that maybe some practices were taking place, so we cannot say that we were completely surprised. Otherwise, it means that we haven't done our job. I mean, we are doing our job very seriously. We're talking to detainees, cross-checking information, talking to them privately with no witness, talking to the guardians of the prison. We are trying to get an overall view and as accurate as possible when we're visiting detention places. Our job is to remind them. Our job is to ensure that there is a follow-up. Our job is to make sure that everything is being monitored and that we insist on the obligation to change things and so that they are in conformity with international humanitarian law. But we cannot induce the change unless the authorities take the decision to do so. We can only pressure them to do it.
Nada Dumani, I want to thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nada Dumani is a spokesperson for the International Red Cross. She joined us from Amman, Jordan.
Just ahead, President Bush addressed the Arab world yesterday about the prison scandal in Iraq. Did he contain the damage? We'll have the view from Beirut.
And later in the show, Alan Greenspan expresses new concern about the soaring federal budget deficit.
There's more to come here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush appeared on two Arab television networks yesterday, attempting to contain the damage caused by the Abu Ghraib scandal. Mr. Bush called the abuse abhorrent and said, "We will find the truth, we will fully investigate, the world will see the investigation, and justice will be served." So how did the president's comments go over in the Arab world? Well, for one view, we're joined by Rami Khoury, executive editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. Welcome, Rami.
Thanks for having me.
It's been pretty clear for a while that there's a great deal of anger in the Arab world about this scandal. So do you think these interviews helped the president at all?
Well, there's actually been a great deal of anger about many dimensions of American policies in the Middle East. And this latest scandal has just made things worse, actually. Not only the scandal itself with the torture and the degradation of the prisoners, but the fact that the president spoke on TV to the people in this region, which is a good thing, but he didn't say anything that really dealt with people's sentiments and perceptions here. So that I think the net impact was negative, and then it's just this, you know, this is getting worse and worse, and somebody should tell the president that, you know, when you're in a hole, stop digging.
When you say the president said nothing in these interviews, he did use fairly strong language condemning these abuses and calling for investigations. Was that not enough?
Yes, that wasn't enough. I mean, it was good that he actually made the effort to go on TV and address the people in this region. I think people appreciate that. But they want a substantive gesture from the United States. The pictures are so awful, and the latest ones that came out in the Washington Post with a soldier having a naked prisoner on a leash. You know, in Arabic, one of the worst insults in Arabic is Ibn al-Kelb, which means you're the son of a dog. And to have somebody in a picture like that and a prisoner on a leash like a dog is unbelievably offensive. And the general sentiment is that people, I think, appreciate that Bush made an effort to address the people in this region, but he didn't deal with the core issue, which is that a terrible deed has been done. And yes, of course, justice will be done, but that's not enough. I mean, what you want is a straightforward apology, a simple apology, and it's really very simple to do.
But with this level of deep feeling, as you described, do you think even an apology would have made that much of a difference?
Yes, a straight, honest, heartfelt, sincere apology would make a huge difference, at least in this issue.
He seemed to be explaining in these interviews what happens in a democracy, in a free society. He said these kinds of abuses are investigated, we have nothing to hide, we believe in transparency. And I wonder whether Mr. Bush was trying to appeal to those in the Arab world who don't live in democratic societies, saying, you know, don't judge us too harshly.
Well, if he was, I think it's kind of misguided. He doesn't understand that most people in this region view the United States as an occupying foreign army. Bush may think that, and he does think that he is a liberator and he's bringing freedom. Most Iraqis just don't buy it. They don't see it that way. And they see this particular incident as just one more example of the terrible things that happen under foreign occupations.
Rami, finally, someone was quoted in your newspaper today as saying they're looking for actions, not words, from the administration. What does the administration have to do to win over some degree of public support?
Well, on the narrow level of the incidents in the prison, they have to obviously put people on trial right away and show that the people who did this have been punished. Then at another level would be more forceful in moving to an American disengagement and turning over sovereignty quickly and efficiently to Iraqis.
Rami, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Rami Khoury is executive editor of the Daily Star. He spoke to us from Beirut.
Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan gave his strongest warning yet about the federal budget deficit in remarks to a meeting of bankers this morning. Greenspan said that the deficit represents a major obstacle to the country's long-term economic stability. Mark Zandi is an economist with Economy.com. He joins us on the line. Welcome, Mark.
It's good to be with you.
Mark, what do you make of these comments from the Federal Reserve Chairman this morning?
He's pointing out that one of our most significant long-term economic threats is the very large budget deficits that we face. Deficits are large today, and prospects are that they're going to remain very large long into the future, and that's a problem.
But why is he bringing this up now? It's been no secret for some time that looming federal deficits could create a perfect economic storm when baby boomers retire and want their benefits.
I think we've had other issues to grapple with up till now, near-term problems, the recession, the weak jobless recovery, the fact we weren't creating any jobs. So I think we just had things that were at a higher level on the agenda. Just we had to worry about other things. But now that the economy is improving and we're seeing some job creation, things are going a little bit better, we need to turn our attention to some of the longer-term problems that we face. And the budget deficit is agenda item number one.
Is this long-term problem likely to rattle the markets in the short term?
It's not one of those things that rattles the market on any given day, any given week, any given month. It's one of those things that weighs on the market over long periods of time. And if you look back over a period of several years, a decade, a generation, if we don't solve or address this problem successfully, we're going to see that we're just going to be a little bit less wealthy than we otherwise would have been. And that would be reflected in lower stock prices and other asset values.
Did Greenspan offer any suggestions for how to deal with the federal deficit?
He didn't in this speech, but he has in other speeches recently. He has focused, for example, on Social Security. He made the point that our deficit problems are going to grow once the large boomer cohort begins to retire in the not-too-distant future and begin to use Social Security and Medicare more intensively. And he strongly suggested we need to address the Social Security problem by raising the retirement age and perhaps making other changes. He hasn't said much about Medicare. That is, in all likelihood, a bigger problem. And he has sort of weighed in on tax cuts. He didn't seem to think that we should raise taxes, although there should be, I think, some fair debate on that as well. I think at some point we need to think about higher taxes to pay for all the things that we've promised to do for our seniors and everyone else.
Mark Zandi is an economist with Economy.com. He joined us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Mark, thanks a lot.
It was a pleasure.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have a report on Donald Rumsfeld's appearance before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
And we review the new film starring Isabella Rossellini, The Saddest Music in the World. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Besides Israel, Jordan's royal family has been as reliable an ally as the United States has had in the Middle East. But the relationship is strained. Last month, King Abdullah canceled a meeting with President Bush to protest the administration's decision to sign on to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to make some settlements in the West Bank permanent. The king is now scheduled to meet President Bush this afternoon, though once again, the White House has gone against his wishes. Earlier this week, it declined to sign a statement that would have allowed Palestinians to be compensated for land lost to Israel. Washington correspondent Salome Namad is covering the story for Saudi Arabia's Al Hayat newspaper. He joins us on the line. Welcome, Salome.
Thank you.
Salome, why is King Abdullah meeting with the president today?
Well, there are many, many things on the agenda. You've got the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Palestinian problem, the situation in Iraq, and as well as a bilateral relationship. All these issues will be discussed, but on top of the agenda, I would imagine, is the Palestinian issue as well as Iraq.
How much, in your mind, in the mind of Jordanians, was it a slap in the face to the king when the Bush administration declined to provide a written statement guaranteeing that somewhere down the line Palestinians would be financially compensated for land lost?
I think the king would understand that the U.S. cannot muddle the waters even further by opening the issue of compensation at this time. However, it doesn't mean that the administration might not still offer the king a statement that refers to, international resolutions dealing with the matter, and that all issues will be open on the table. It will be basically a matter of using the right language to satisfy both sides without necessarily muddying the waters or taking away from the U.S. commitments to Israel.
Salome, in the wake of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal in Iraq, isn't President Bush radioactive, so to speak, for any Arab leader to stand beside?
Yes, I think it's going to be a very tough meeting for the king and, in terms of his image in his own country, He's expected to, say something about what happened, to condemn it. At the same time, Jordan has, strategic interests with the United States. It's an ally. Jordan is very close in terms of the war against terrorism, a close ally with the United States. And as such, the king cannot be too critical of the president. And at the same time, he needs the president to extend support for Jordan, which fears that the failure of the Palestinian-Israeli process could push towards more extremism, considering that more than half of Jordan's population is of Palestinian origin. And this is a very, very polarizing factor and a threat to Jordanian national security. He needs the assurances of the Bush administration. He cannot be too critical at this time, but it's a very, very awkward, fine moment for the king. And it's almost like a minefield that he has to walk through without upsetting, not upsetting the Bush administration, at the same time not appearing to be accommodating violations by U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and letting that go without a mention.
Salome Nemat, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mr. Nemat is Washington correspondent for the Al Hayat newspaper.
Close to 70 retired American diplomats have signed a letter protesting the Bush administration's stance on the Middle East peace process. The letter criticizes the president for his endorsement of Israel's plan to redraw parts of the map of the Middle East without consulting Palestinian leaders. Its authors plan to present the letter to the president at the end of this month. One of the signatories is Robert Keeley, a former ambassador to Greece, Zimbabwe, and Mauritius. He joins us from his home in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you.
Now, could you tell us why you signed this letter?
Well, it's because I strongly agree with the views it expresses. For a long time, until recently, that is, U.S. policy has been that a solution to the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians must be negotiated by the two sides with, whenever possible, the U.S. acting as a mediator or honest broker. But recently, what happened was that the honest broker and one side got together and decided in large measure the outcome of three of the four final status issues under the Oslo Agreement, that they were to be negotiated by the two sides. These issues were settlements, borders, refugees. Thus, what we now have is an agreement reached behind the backs of the Palestinians without any consultation with them, and it ends any hope that the U.S. can continue as an honest broker, since we've now irrevocably chosen to side with one side to the exclusion of the other.
And you think this imperils the peace process?
Well, it certainly imperils our role in it, and we've played a principal role for maybe 37 years, since 1967, and we've now stated what we think the final status ought to be, rather than have it negotiated between the two sides.
Ambassador, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Robert Keeley is a former U.S. ambassador. Well, we turn now to another former U.S. diplomat who chose not to sign the letter of protest. Edward Walker is president of the Middle East Institute. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Good to be here.
Now, you chose not to sign this letter. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I think that the letter is too categoric in what it says. It paints everything in black and white terms, very much like some people in the Bush administration paint the issues. I don't think everything is in black and white. I think there are some positive things on both sides. I think there's some opportunities in the offers that Sharon made and some dangers as well. And I would have to feel that it reflected those nuances.
Do you have any specific problems with the Bush administration decision to publicly support Ariel Sharon's plans?
I think the administration went too far in being in defining away the problem of some settlements and defining away the problem of the right of return. I think that will complicate our efforts in the future when we try to make to help the parties reach a peace agreement. But I can understand why the administration wanted to take advantage of this offer to take all the settlements out of Gaza.
Now, the circles that you travel in of ex-diplomats and Middle East experts, how divided is this community about current Bush administration policy?
Well, I think that a lot of us would like to give him the benefit of the doubt. We like to give any president the benefit of the doubt. I think that most of the people I talk to, senior former diplomats like Sam Lewis and Tom Pickering and others, Dick Murphy, feel that this is a very complicated situation and that it needs a lot of hard work and leadership from the President of the United States, but that we can't take categoric positions on things as if it was cut and dried.
Ambassador, thank you very much.
You bet.
Ambassador Edward Walker is president of the Middle East Institute.
Still to come, she's a former computer programmer, but she has a hot new career in music. We'll talk to Vienna Tang.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We received a lot of response to our coverage of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal in Iraq. In an interview with Tom Bowman of the Baltimore Sun, he said that Army investigators had looked into reports that an MP and military policeman had sex with one of the female detainees. This prompted Marion Peters of Heartland, Vermont to write, "Having sex happens between two consenting individuals. What happened in the course of an abusive, coercive situation, such as existed in that prison, is sexual assault or rape. I was disappointed that the correspondent referred to that despicable act in that informal, deceptive way and that he wasn't called on it."
Dave Mays of Tequilma, Oregon, also responded to that story. He wrote to us saying he wanted an apology from President Bush, so we decided to call him.
I feel like the situation is very tense right now, and especially the Arab world with this prison torture situation coming out. And I thought an apology to the Arab press, specifically Al Jazeera, by President Bush would help to diffuse some of this tension and prevent or at least lessen the chances of there being, you know, a terrorist backlash from this situation.
Well, President Bush did speak extensively to the Arab press, and he said he found the abuse abhorrent. Is that enough for you?
I think it's a step in the right direction. It didn't really feel like an apology. Didn't really expect an apology necessarily, being an election year and him being, you know, concerned with his poll ratings and such.
Dave, thanks very much.
Thank you, Deborah.
And we had this from Robin Stelly of Yardley, Pennsylvania, about our interview with Youssef Ibrahim of the Gulf News. He talked about how the photos from Abu Ghraib make Arab leaders uncomfortable because of the thousands of people imprisoned in Arab states. Before we get feeling too smug about that situation, let's remember that at least one of the GIs in those photos had experience working in the U.S. prison system, and that we have our own largely unreported prison crisis happening here.
Our story last week on Boston talk radio host Jay Severin, who came under heavy criticism for declaring, quote, "I think we should kill them," in response to a caller saying that Muslims in the U.S. should be befriended, drew this response from George Washington III of Charlotte, North Carolina. Had he said this about African Americans, he would have been fired immediately. But apparently, to the management of his radio station, it's okay, since he was appealing to the creeping fear of America's enemies, regardless of the fact that he was calling a significant portion of the United States population terrorists and traitors. It's disgusting, it's inflammatory, and it appeals to lowest common denominator fears and idiocy.
And finally, Leah Hauk of Henniker, New Hampshire, wanted to know what that music was that we played during our talk with Steve Almond about his new book, Candy Freak, which chronicles his and America's love affair with candy. Well, of course, it was the band Presidents of the United States of America with their own ode to the sweet stuff, Candy, off the album Presidents of the United States of America. Here's another taste.
Take off the lid and there you are. You're my candy. Candy.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at HERE-NOW.ORG.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Bonnie Bick is a 60-year-old woman who lives in a two-story brick house overlooking the Potomac River. And for more than a decade, she's been fighting a developer's plans to put a 500-acre resort almost next door. She says she fears the $2 billion project will bring gambling to the neighborhood. But Bick now has a new fight on her hands. Prince George's County has announced plans to condemn her house and tear it down and replace it with a drainage basin. County officials say it's nothing personal, but Bick thinks otherwise, and she joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now tell us, first of all, how did you hear of these plans to tear down your house?
Well, my first notice was a letter that an appraiser sent to me saying that they wanted to appraise my house in order to demolish it and widen Oxon Hill Road.
You think this is not a coincidence, that your opposition to this big resort is somehow related to these plans to demolish your house?
Well, it's difficult not to feel that way, since all my energy has been spent trying to work for this better vision, and now to have my house targeted, it does feel personal. Because I live on a hill, and I'm surrounded on two sides by deep ravines, and to have a stormwater pond up so high on a hill doesn't make hydrologic sense.
Why not just take the money the county's offering and move somewhere else where you know there's not going to be a 500-acre resort next door?
Well, I just don't think that I could live with myself if I did that.
Your father designed your house, is that correct?
That is correct, yes. And I grew up in this house and was a very fortunate to have a happy childhood, and I purchased the house from my brothers when my mother died, and I'm very attached to the house.
What are you going to do?
We intend to win. That's our goal.
Bonnie, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Deb.
Bonnie Bick joined us on the line from Prince George's County, Maryland.
Before she recorded her first album, Waking Hour, 3 years ago, 25-year-old pianist and singer Vienna Tang wasn't writing songs for a living. She was writing computer code at Cisco Systems in California. Now the classically trained pianist is happily touring the country in support of her latest release, Warm Strangers. Started taking piano when she was only 5 years old, wrote her first song at age six, and studied classical music until she went to school at Stanford University. There, her career as a songwriter began to blossom with support from her fans, the internet, and eventually a contract with Vert Records. That enabled her to quit her programming job to perform and play full-time. Vienna calls her classically influenced music chamber folk. And she's in the studio to talk about her music and herself. Welcome, Vienna.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Bill.
It's great to have you. You know, you called your music chamber folk, and that seems about right. Where did the name come from?
I've been struggling for a name for the genre of music that I play. I don't really know what it is, but I feel like I rely a bit on the aesthetic of classical music, since that's my background in terms of musical training. But it's definitely very storytelling and description-oriented music. So I felt like folk music was a more appropriate moniker than pop music.
Let's hear the cut that opens the album. It's called Feather Moon.
Feather moon, scarlet sky, living clouds, my blinded eye. Water's black. Breathe in, breathe out, exhale in.
was struck right away by the violin, because your first album, Waking Hour, is very spare, very autobiographical. And here there's a richness right away and throughout this album.
That was sort of the intent of putting Feather Moon first, although there was a bit of debate that went into it. And I wanted that to be kind of the opening statement for the album. This is a different sound. This is a different approach. You're right in that my first album, Waking Hour, was very much stripped down in a lot of ways, partly out of circumstance. I recorded the album in college, and so sometimes all we had at our disposal was a piano and a microphone, and so we thought, well, we might as well just keep it solo. But when we went to make this album, I really wanted to explore what could be done with violin and cello.
You paint a picture of San Francisco, where you live. You went to Stanford on the song Mission Street. It starts off with some street sounds. Let's hear it.
That is actually literally Mission Street. I live on that street in San Francisco, and it's a very loud place a lot of the time, and I have very thin windows. And so what we did, we were recording the album in Nashville, but I sent a friend to my apartment with some recording gear and said, just hold the microphone out my window and see what you get.
Mission Street, is it striking dark at stranger? Speaks a language I don't know, but long to learn. As cadences fall endlessly beyond the window pane, as I sit as though awaiting some return. My heart.
Mission Street is, I guess, one of the autobiographical songs. It's about not being able to sleep in this noisy place, because I grew up in the suburbs, which is dead quiet. So it was really about me trying to figure out why I wanted to be here and what I was doing and my reasons for it, and just kind of evoking this new landscape that I had put myself in.
An interesting song on the new album, Shasta, Carrie's song, which is a song about abortion. Let's hear it.
So far, so good, but you can't go on much longer. Jesus knows what you've been through. Take the Savior into your heart, my child. There's love waiting for the both of you. Well, you don't believe.
It's actually not about abortion. It's actually about not having an abortion, something that I was interested in exploring as a topic.
Okay.
Because I felt like the debate is often separated into people saying that, you know, babies are precious and you cannot kill, you know, another living thing, and then other people saying it's about women's choice, and nobody really talks about, well, what about the possibility of a woman making that actual choice to actually have the child, and what is involved in that personal journey.
Yeah, it walks a nice line, though, that song.
Right.
There is an ambiguity to it.
There is, and I feel like that song has actually raised a lot of questions among my fans about what religious affiliation I actually have, because there's a Christian activist who's handing out pamphlets, and this girl, the subject of the song, actually picks up one of the pamphlets and changes her mind. And so people are wondering whether I'm espousing that particular political point of view, which I'm not, but I feel like that is a situation in which someone might actually be moved to change their position on something.
You ended up having about 3 years to create the second album. Now you're touring, and you're doing this full time. Are the songs still coming? How do you feel about the third album, just to finish up, because you'll want to do one?
Yes, I will want to make a third album. And at this point, I feel like I'm going to have to take some time off and do something else, because I find that a lot of the best songs that I write are written in moments of procrastination, when I should be doing something else. For me to actually sit down and devote myself to writing songs, I think, is a disastrous way to go about it. I feel like I really need to get distracted by some other pursuit, and then the songs will come naturally, I think.
Deanna Tang, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Deanna Tang's new CD is called Warm Strangers. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org.
It's desert ice outside, but this diner's thawed my ears. Hot coffee in a clean white mug and a smile when the waitress hears.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Deborah Wong.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
And we used to play the same pizza bar.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.